You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings, and we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And welcome back to Revelation City. Okay, this is our second week looking at the last book of the Bible. And of course, I have no idea what you already know about the last book of the Bible, but I'll bet that many of us, if we know one thing about Revelation, know that it's about the end of the world. And maybe that's such a strong emphasis because the thing is just so weird. If you read Revelation and you think, this is the ranting of a mad lunatic, I mean, I wouldn't blame you. There's some weird stuff. But the thing is, those end of the world colors are so bright that once we've been shown them, it can be very difficult to see anything else. But what if there was something else going on? What if predicting the end times wasn't the main purpose of this book? What if the main purpose of this book was something much more grounded, much more down to earth? Well, here's what Daryl Johnson says about why he titled his book on Revelation, Discipleship on the Edge. He says that Revelation is not a crystal ball revealing esoteric secrets that enable one to escape the harsh realities of life on earth, but Revelation is a down-to-earth manual on how to be a disciple of Jesus facing the harsh realities of life on the earth. In particular, how to do this the way that Jesus did and does. So yes, this conversation will be wild. It might even feel wacky at times. And yes, we'll be talking with straight faces about dragons and many-headed beasts, but our aim will be to show how those out-of-this-world images are actually aiming our hearts at real life following Jesus here and now. And our goal, as always, when we talk about the scriptures in college life, is to help you know these texts a little bit better, not just so you'd have the knowledge, but that that knowledge would turn to affection, and that affection would actually change your life. So let's not be scared of Revelation. Let's open that sucker up. Enjoy the podcast. All right, can I tell you guys something embarrassing?
Yeah.
So, okay, we're recording this at 8 p.m. this
which
time.
Which is unusual,
morning people.
Right?
Yeah, very unusual. And I got to be honest, when I am driving to the church at night, I am never more than like 35% certain that I'm turning into the right driveway.
There's so many weird driveways out there.
There's so many weird driveways, but I've been working here for like 7.5 years. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And I'm never sure. I always think I passed it. It's unbelievable. Okay, we have Christian Wingate in the house, Stanford. What's up, my man?
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
You are a master of membranes for your day job and inexplicably a wise theological thinker for your night job, apparently.
Those two are inherently connected. I'll leave the audience to figure out how.
Okay. Yeah. I have no idea.
I want to know what's weirder, a master of membranes or a sediment transport expert?
I was gonna say that like, hey, it's 8 o'clock, we've all worked our day jobs.
That's right.
Like, Christian's working with milk, you're working with water, and I'm working with holy water or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
So okay, this is for the 1% of our listeners who know what we're talking about, Stanford. I'm looking at you, John Bailey. But if you are Joe House, Stanford, what does that make Christian? Like Klosterman or Gladwell or Shea Serrano or something
Klosterman.
Like that?
Oh, he's Serrano.
You can be Klosterman.
Yeah. If we're going to ask John Bailey, then it's Shea Serrano.
Yeah. Shout out to you, John Bailey. All right. We are in the midst of Revelation mania here at College Life, which has been awesome. And I got to say, I know I said this when we were doing the epistles and stuff, but big fan of reading the scriptures and then talking about it with other people who have read the same scriptures. Big fan of that process. Super fun. Way better than just reading the scriptures alone and way better than just like spewing the knowledge that happens to be on the top of your head. So fun. So anyway, we are in Revelation. And if you have seen the musical Les Mis, then you might think, oh, I really want to try to read the book Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. And you might think that, oh, I know the story, you know, like I've been given the highlights in the musical form. And then you go to the novel and it's like hundreds of pages of like French warfare and like tedious battles and stuff like that. And you might be thinking, I wish that someone had prepared me for the fact that this is actually way harder than it purported to be when you saw the musical. And so I feel like that's sort of what we have set people up to do. If we were to have stopped right now, and this is like our only treatment of Revelation, then people would think like, oh, Revelation's great. Revelation's just some really cool Jesus stuff, talks to the churches, really pristine little micro epistles. And then they're going to get to some of actual what Revelation is in the meat of it. And they'd be like, what?
What's going on?
You'd think you would have mentioned yeah. this.
Then you start blowing trumpets and pouring out bowls and everything goes to heck.
Right, right.
And I think you can use the word hell here because I think
it quite literally goes to hell. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that does. That's true. So it's tempting to sometimes just talk about the best of something and then make it sound really awesome.
Right.
And then someone just goes and they read it and like, wait, this is not what I signed up for. You did not prepare me for this. So we want people to hopefully love Revelation. And if we don't touch any of the stuff that's just bonkers, out of this world craziness, then we're going to not prepare people well for it. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Our goal is to tackle just one of the chapters that is just out there. People have had thoughts on this chapter. It ends with the number 666. And so that's a big chapter. Deal. People have had thoughts on that. So that's what we're going to do. We are going to dive into Revelation 13 and we're going to read it. These guys are going to interrupt me as I read through it when they have thoughts and interesting things to say. And then we're going to close with some nice images of Revelation, a little Revelation dessert.
Before we get started, I just want to know that there is a phobia about the fear of the number 666. And I'm just going to give it a shot of how to pronounce it because it's at least 40 letters. All right. Here we go. This is hexacoisio hexaconta hexaphobia.
That's awesome.
At least 40 letters.
A lot of hexes.
3 to be precise.
All right. So before we dive in to Revelation 13, be good to have two separate preliminaries. And the first is just the fancy term is like the hermeneutic method. But that's sort of lame. We're not going to say that. Just the term is like, how are you approaching the book?
Yeah.
Like, how are we approaching Revelation? And I'm going to go on a limb. I guess this may be a lukewarm take, but like how you approach this book in particular determines more about what you're going to end up with than like any other book you read. You know, you can read through the Gospels with sort of any old lens and you can sort of make some sense of it. But the lens through which you read Revelation, you come to drastically different conclusions.
That's right.
And, you know, perhaps if you know what people think about Revelation, I mean, one of the most prevailing things is that a lot of people think it's, you know, like this like code text where we have to figure out like, when is the end of the world happening? When is Jesus coming back to like annihilate everybody? And so what you do is you sort of get all your pieces together and you look at, oh, there's like locusts in the text, what that really means is like helicopters in the sky during war. And so maybe during this war times, actually it's like the end of the world. And it's like, you take the text and it's like, you use it to figure out how the world's going to end. And you use these things as little clues to figure out the codes. And I'm going to say that's not what we're going to do. And actually what we're going to do is think primarily this text is about the past. It gives us hope for the future and it assures us of the future. But the way to understand it is to look back at John's context, look back at what's happening in John's time and John's world and how he's making sense of the world and what the images that he's talking about, how they're interacting with his world and his day. The beautiful thing and the wonderful thing and the sort of transcendent thing is actually that's true for John, but the way that this is written, the story that it's telling, the sort of meta narrative about reality that's going on is that it's not actually just about the past. Actually, this is going to be like these meta stories that we're going to dive into are actually happening not just in John's time, but also in Augustine's time and Luther's time and Martin Luther King's time and our time and our kids' time and our grandkids' time. You know, it's a story that's going to keep repeating itself. It's sort of the superstructure of the whole story of reality, which I know sounds like sort of crazy talk, but
and that might be like almost disappointing. Like that for me, for my own journey with Revelation, like when I started learning of like, oh, it's not all about future prophecy, is like, man, that future prophecy stuff is like really interesting. It's like crazy. It's fun to think about. It's almost like addictive in the way that you like want to think about it.
Yeah.
And so hearing that it's like, oh, this is maybe all about the first century, it's not as exciting. It's not as glamorous. You're not going to get any headlines with that. But as we kind of travel through and see how John is actually working the text and working these images that are, I mean, really drawn from the entirety of scripture and applying them to his day and then giving us the tools to apply them to ours, it actually gets way more interesting. It gets way better. Every symbol, instead of looking for the decoding of the symbol in our modern day, it actually becomes like this incredibly powerful tool that he's using, you learn that there's no symbol in this line that's like just descriptive or just like just kind of thrown in there. Like every line in this book is a hard hitter. And so this mm-hmm. book becomes more and more fascinating the more you study it.
Right.
There's a sense in which, you know, John's trying to sneak this through past the prison censors, right? He's in prison. He's sending this out. And so, like, you get your average Roman prison censor is going to read this and think it's the ravings of a madman, right? Because that yeah. maybe is, like, your first impression of what's going on here. But the more you look at this and the more you realize that these symbols are connected to first century events and personalities, and that the whole structure of the book actually builds on the themes throughout scripture. And it just becomes this really complicated and beautiful and complex and textured work of art that also had to like sneak past prison censors, the kind of the more exciting it becomes.
Yeah.
And so one of the critical components to understanding what John is writing here is understanding like what this piece of literature is. And so it's really easy to think, because it's dream literature, because it's vision literature, that it's just like stream of consciousness. Like John is getting this beamed into his head from Jesus and he's writing it down word for word. And the moment he finishes, he puts stamps on it and sends it out to seven churches. But we have a lot of evidence that this is actually a really well-crafted text, that John actually probably sat down and crafted this. And one of the things that Stanford talked about last week is how chapter one, actually the symbols surrounding Jesus, they're actually like chiastically woven into the seven letters of the church. A chiasm is just a structure that goes A, B, C, B, A. And so there's a really clear structure imposed on these seven letters. So John has taken his time crafting it. The other thing is that apocalyptic just means unveiling. It doesn't mean the end of the world. And it actually is a genre of literature that exists at this time. Daniel is the other example from our Bible, but there's actually other first century literature that is written in apocalyptic. And it's generally these really extreme, grandiose symbols and imagery. And what it's meant to do is to convey, here is the cosmic reality underneath what we're seeing right now. Here is mm-hmm. the cosmic significance underneath it all. And so it's kind of like apocalyptic literature is like the end of The Wizard of Oz, when Toto pulls back the curtain and he reveals that the wizard is just this actually man, you know, working this little machine. But it's actually the opposite of that. Like, we're pulling the curtain behind the man, and what we're seeing are the spiritual realities lying behind him. Like, we're seeing this man, Toto pulls back the curtain, and look, it's Satan. Mm-hmm.
That is a much darker movie.
Yes, that is, yeah, it's a much darker movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to say that again, because it's the foundational shift that many people will have to make, is that apocalypse does not mean the end of the world. That's apocalypse right. means unveiling, mm-hmm. uncovering. It means getting a glimpse into reality where you didn't have it before. It's like in The Truman Show when he figures out the world he's in. Like that's a moment of apocalypse for him, when he figures it out, when he actually sees what reality is, and reality was not what it seemed to him before.
So yeah, I feel like in some ways there's a feeling of specialness that attends the book of Revelation. Like, I remember when I was kind of trained to read it as, you know, the looking for the symbols in Revelation in the newspaper of that day, there was this sense of real specialness. Like, history's been going on for a long time and I'm super special right. because I'm at the end of it, right? But like, if you think yeah. about what the scriptures are, that doesn't make much sense, that there would be a book of the scriptures that made no sense to the people who read it at the time, and was inaccessible to 2,000 years of Christians, because each of these symbols has some future referent that they have no access to. And so like right, yeah. most of history would read this book and be confused and unnourished by it. And just like, why is that even in there? When instead mm-hmm. it's a book about the first century with themes that recapitulate in every generation. And so instead, it actually does connect with my newspaper, but it also connected with John Calvin's newspaper, and it also connected with Augustine's newspaper, and it'll connect with my daughter's newspaper. And in that way, it's a book that keeps giving. And in that way, it is special.
Yeah. And like the locust thing, right? It's like, what makes more sense? Like, there is a pretty thick theme of locusts in the scriptures. And so when locusts show up in Revelation, is it more likely that it's referring back to all the stuff that's happened before in locusts and sort of drawing out that theme in that reality? Or is it more likely that, just like you said, it's like, yeah, in 2000 years, there's going to be an event where helicopters have, you know, taken on the day, and actually the locusts have been referring to that this whole time. You just had no idea what the technology of helicopters were, so you wouldn't know. That doesn't make much sense. So anyway, Before we dive into Revelation 13, I think we need to know a little bit about Revelation 12, because Revelation 13 is not a standalone part of the scriptures. It's part of a little section of Revelation in between some other stuff, and really it's a meta section. And so, Christian, can you just bring us to Revelation 12? Just catch us up a little bit with what we need
Absolutely. To know. Absolutely. So Revelation 12 and 13 are the literary heart of the book. At this point, you know, we've had the micro epistles, we've had some throne room visions of God, we've had some plagues. This is going to introduce the central conflict.
We've had some plagues. Just a few plagues.
Casual. Seven to be precise.
There's been horsemen who are named like death famine.
Right. And I mean, the fact that we are actually in a plague just seems like we should be a little less casual.
Right, that's true.
So Revelation 12 is going to introduce us to the cosmic conflict, and it's going to introduce us to some characters. The first is going to be a woman. This is like a cosmic woman. She's crowned with stars, and she's pregnant. She's crying out in birth pains, and all of a sudden this dragon shows up, and this dragon wants to eat her baby. I'm just going to let that sit.
A baby-eating dragon.
Yep, I'm going to let that sit. So she gives birth to a male child, and you know the dragon is rather upset about this and chases her into the wilderness. There's this big war in heaven with the angels, and they defeat the dragon. It sounds like nonsense, but one of the things you have to look at when you look at Revelation is Revelation is the final book of our canon. It is the conclusion to every plot line, and it's also drawing on every design pattern, on every image throughout the entirety of Scripture. So when you approach Revelation, you should expect to see callbacks to previous plot lines, to previous images. It's like if you were to, you know, watch a Netflix series, if you were to watch the show Lost or something, and you just watched the last episode, and that was the only episode you watched, and it was wrapping up 25 plot lines and all of these characters' story arcs, and you were very confused because you don't understand what happened for the last six seasons. Like, that's what happens when you read Revelation and you're not super, super well-versed in the scriptures. That's one of the challenges of reading it, is because it's constantly calling back. And so what this story of the woman and the dragon is calling back to is actually Genesis 3. It's what's called the proto-gospel sometimes. It's a promise that God makes to Eve that she is going to give birth to the serpent crusher, the snake crusher, and that, you know, he will crush the serpent's head and the serpent will bite his heel. And so this dragon is called the ancient serpent Satan. Like, John straight up tells you, he doesn't do this very many times, but he does it here. He says, the dragon is Satan. End of story. Full stop.
Ancient serpent from Genesis 1, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the child is, you know, obviously Christ. And so what's happening here is this is actually a retelling of, like, the nativity scene. It's a retelling of the birth of Jesus and what is happening on the cosmic scale when that happens. This is the cosmic significance of Jesus's birth, which is remarkable because there's a dragon at it. You don't see a lot of dragons in nativity scenes. Right. And I have told Olivia, if we ever have a nativity scene in our house, in our front yard, there will be a giant inflatable dragon in it. And people will come knocking and tell me, that's blasphemous. And I'll say, no, it's not.
Revelation 12.
Open up Revelation 12, brother. Yeah.
I have to say, when I read Revelation, it just takes a long time. And not because it's hard to read, right? The words are of the same difficulty. It's just because I'm always flipping back to Daniel, to Ezekiel, to Isaiah, to Genesis, to Exodus. Mm-hmm. Like, it is so intertwined with the themes of the Hebrew scriptures and with the Gospels that it just takes me a long time because I am so kind of drawn in by how it's intertwined. And it's funny you should bring up Lost, because I did watch Lost, like many of the suckers in the world during that time. And
Count me in as a sucker.
Yep. But there's a really interesting thing that happens in Lost. Episode 117. There are 120 episodes. Episode 117 takes a break from the main characters in Lost. And what does it do? It goes back many, many, many years before any of those characters were born. And it tells the story of the origin story of the island and of, like, the separation of good and evil and essentially the fall. And that's exactly what Revelation 12 is doing. We're almost at the end of the series. We're 99.4. Yes, I did count. I did calculate it based on number of verses. 99.4% through the Bible. And what does God do?
tells us the story of the fall of the angels and the fall of humans. Like, brings us back not only to the first, to the third chapter of the Bible, but what happens before that. It tells us the proto-narrative and reminds us this is how we got here. And then everything happened, and now I'm going to wrap it up with episodes 118 through 120, which are much more satisfying than those in the series Lost.
I love Lost. I won't hear any Lost slander. So basically what I want in our minds as we go into Revelation 13 is the dragon. That dragon who is calling back to the snake that's in Genesis 3, who sort of causes the fall, causes the chaos. And the picture that we get of this dragon is that this dragon is sort of like evil incarnate.
He is
like this dragon
the primary antagonist of God.
Yes. Of the whole story. If you think about like you hold the book in the Bible in your hand, the protagonist, God, antagonist, this dragon. This like dragon. This is a big, bad, really, 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 really bad, you know? Like the substance of all evil, really, and the source of it.
And the chapter uses six names for him: Deceiver, mm-hmm. Devil, Satan, Dragon, Accuser, and the Ancient Serpent. And those are basically all the names that are used for this character throughout the whole metatext.
Yeah. But much like, you know, I don't know, Tony Soprano or Don Corleone or whatever, like the big boss, like the Don, the big, big, bad, evil one, rarely gets his hands the dirtiest. And so he has these little underlings, and that's what we're going to be reading about in Revelation 13. I'm just going to give you a little spoiler. We're going to come across two beasts, and these two beasts are doing the bidding and are animated by and are wanting the dragon to be worshipped. So they're doing the bidding of the dragon, and they exist to like have the dragon be worshipped. And so I don't want you to picture sort of like the Russian nesting dolls. Like the dragon is like as bad as it gets. And then he's got these two underlings, sort of capos or whatever in the mob, I guess. And
Peter, and your mob knowledge is excellent.
So that's what I want you to picture. So when we're coming across these beasts, even though it's sort of talking about the beasts, we're also sort of talking about that dragon. It's sort of like they kind of go back and forth and they are animating each other and they're sort of interacting together, sort of like how we talk about the Trinity. You know, we talk about God, Jesus, Holy Spirit. We talk about them distinctly and we also talk about them together. Like a lot of people have called the dragon and these two beasts the sort of unholy Trinity. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do, which you've never done before on the pod, is I'm just going to read the text of Revelation 13. And then I'm going to invite Christian and Stanford to do what I'm going to call some holy interruptions. So when we come across something that you guys have thoughts on, you think would be helpful to explain or even show how we're using this sort of looking back at the past sort of reading of Revelation, then just stop me and we'll talk about it. There's a lot to talk about. I know that we have a lot of thoughts. So let's dive in, man. Revelation 13:1 starts like this. It says, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard."
Wait, hold on. That sounds really familiar.
We got to stop. We got a holy interruption, baby.
No, keep going.
Okay. Its feet were like a bear's.
Wait.
And its mouth was...
Hold on. This is all sounding really familiar. All right. Keep going.
And its mouth was like a lion's mouth.
Okay.
And to it, oh, go ahead.
You finish.
Okay. And to it, the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority.
Okay, we'll stop there. It's like, I feel like it's that interrupting sloth joke. That's all super familiar. We got this creature that has 10 diadems and is part leopard and is part bear and is part lion. Okay, first of all, that's like a super weird creature. It's like a Frankenstein creature. But the reason that seems familiar is because last Tuesday I talked about Daniel 7. And before I talked about Daniel 7, I obviously read all of Daniel 7. And there is
good preaching
a creature.
Practice.
Actually, there are four creatures in Revelation 7 that emerge from the sea. One is a leopard, one is a bear, one is a lion with wings, and one has 10 horns. So what we've got is a concatenation of these Daniel creatures that is coming out of the sea, and we're calling it the beast. There's got to be something there.
So
I like to think of it as a blender.
An animal blender.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're putting all these things in a blender, and it's coming out with this new...
You know, that's not how blenders work.
My kids used to have these, like... My kids used to have these, like, toy animals, and one was, like, a lion, and one was, like, a tiger, and one was, like, a horse, except you could take the butt off of one and put it on the other. And
say,
And, like, as they put them together, I think that's what I think of. It's, like, the face of a goat and the butt of a cheetah. Like, that's what I think of here.
Right.
So here's going to be our big thesis for the night. This first beast of Revelation 13 is Rome. Like, John has Rome fully in mind. Why do we think that? Well, these four beasts in Daniel 7, Daniel straight up tells us these are human empires that will come. They are human empires. And John is sitting in the face of Rome, and he just took every one of those pieces of beasts and put them all together into one super beast, the Roman Empire. Like, the biggest super beast.
Put it in a blender, is what I'm saying.
Peter, blenders make smoothies?
Yeah, but so do Roman phalanxes, right? Like, this is the hegemony blender, where you've essentially, you take all of these, essentially these pieces of ancient kingdoms that once ruled, you put them all under one military rule behind the Roman phalanx, and you make one super beast.
What's the word you're saying? Phalanx?
The phalanx. That's what made Rome so strong, is their military formation.
Gotcha. Okay, that's military formation.
And we'll talk a little bit in more detail as we read on about why specifically it's Rome. But I mean, it's pretty clear just from this passage alone that John has Rome in mind. But here's the thing. I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to skip ahead to actually Revelation 18. John's going to use the name Babylon for Rome. He actually never says the word Rome anywhere in the book. So the question is, why does he call it Babylon? Like, what's significant about Babylon? Babylon is the archetypal evil empire in the scriptures. It is the thing that both Jews and Christians throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament will refer to when they want to refer to something as like an extremely evil structure. They will call it Babylon. It becomes a design pattern throughout scripture. And so when John draws on this language of Babylon, he's calling Rome Babylon. He's saying, this is what Rome is. It has become this evil empire that is empowered by the dragon. It is empowered by Satan. That is where it is deriving its power from. I mean, verse 2, and to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and his authority. That is a monstrous claim against Rome. He's saying everything Rome does, all of its power, all of its influence, all of its wealth, even its peace is actually empowered by Satan. And what that means, why John uses the term Babylon, is because he's drawing on a former design pattern to apply it to his day. And because he never actually uses the word Rome in Revelation, that actually allows us to look at our power structures of our day and go, oh, are those Babylons too? Like, it's not just that there was this one evil empire that Jesus wanted to tell John about. It's that there's many. This is a cyclical pattern that happens throughout history.
Yeah, it would be sort of an interesting story if this story was just about how bad Rome was. Yeah. But this story is about how Rome is another example about Babylon. Rome is another example of Egypt. Rome is another Assyria. Rome is just another big bad empire. And the point that it's making is that all of these empires are animated by the same force. All of these empires might be in different regions, they might have to speak a different language, but they all share a similar thing, and that's they're animated by the dragon. There's something about their, just like you said, the power and the violence and the dehumanization that's animated by the dragon. And, you know, and it's, I mean, it's not tough to see. I mean, these empires are called beasts. I mean, they're beastly. They have bestial qualities. They are subhuman in that way. You know what I mean?
Bruce Metzger is a Revelation scholar, and he says Babylon is this. He says Babylon is allegorical of the idolatry that any nation commits when it elevates material abundance, military prowess, technological sophistication, imperial grandeur, racial pride, and any other glorification of the creature over the creator. The message of the book of the Revelation concerns God's judgments not only of persons, but also of nations, and in fact, of all principalities and powers, which is to say, all authorities, corporations, institutions, structures, bureaucracies, and the like.
Yeah, so the whole shebang.
Whole shebang.
Animated by the dragon. You know, I will admit that sometimes when I hear talk like what we're talking about right now, it's like, how do you know Like, how do you know this is what they're saying? You know? And I think that, you know, I've heard it said that Revelation and particularly these images are sort of like the way that we deal with like political cartoons. Like if somebody 300 years ago saw, we go back in time, bring a political cartoon of ours 300 years ago. And like, why is this donkey getting mad at the elephant? You know, like what's, right. Why is that happening? Why are they eating food? That doesn't make any sense. And it's like, well, no, we just get it. Like we've just been in this long enough. We just get it. And I think Daniel 7 was such an important chapter that if you start mentioning leopards and bears and lions, it's like, that's we, right. It's just, you know, you get it. Just like we get that a bear is Russia. You know, we just get that, you know? So this would not have been hard, I don't think, for John's audience to sort of piece together that it's like, oh yeah, you know about Babylon, you know about Assyria, yeah. You know about Egypt. They're beastly. They're animated by the dragon. And guess what? This one that we're in right now, Rome, it's an amalgamation of all of them. You know, it's just another example of the same pattern that's been repeating and will repeat. And I think that's probably what we need to know about that. Let's keep reading. So we talked about the beasts and the dragon. So then it says that one of its heads, one of this beast's heads, one of the many, as we remember.
One of the heads.
Yeah, one of the heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?
Full stop. Holy interruption.
Holy interruption.
So this mortal wound is exactly what we just talked about. This mortal wound is the reincarnation of an empire that has died and somehow come back to life, and people are like, oh, why is evil empire back around? Like, didn't it die with Babylon? Didn't it die with Assyria? Didn't it die with Persia? Didn't it die with Greece? And it keeps coming back. It's cyclical. It's got this mortal wound that's healed because it's just always coming back in some new form or another. And the secondary thing about this is one of the reasons we also think, you know, this is very clearly Rome is actually because more than likely John is pointing towards Nero here specifically, not just Rome, but Nero. Now, Nero is long dead by this point, but there was...
Who's Nero?
Nero. So Nero was the Roman emperor in the 60s. He was arguably responsible for the fire in Rome. He persecuted the Christians to the most extreme extent that happened in the first century.
And so what is it about the scar that makes us think this is Nero?
So there were several rumors going around in the late 90s that Nero, who was dead now, was going to rise from the dead and rule Rome again. And this mortal wound is actually playing on that rumor, on this myth that's going around and saying, yeah, this beast that's coming up, it's like Nero. And actually the 666 that comes up later at the end of this chapter is also going to be a likely reference to Nero. It's likely going to be kind of a form of Hebrew riddle called gematria. And it's a way of spelling things with numbers. It spells out Nero. I know that sounds codey, and that's probably the most codey thing that exists in Revelation that's actually probably legit. But more than likely what we're referring to is Nero here. But it doesn't really matter if it's Nero. It's clearly Rome, because if it is Nero, it's functioning as a synecdoche for Rome, as a part for the whole.
But also, like, the way Nero died is he committed suicide by attendant, right? A battle went sideways, and he pulled out his sword and had all of his attendants pull out their sword and then, like, asked them to start killing themselves, and he couldn't quite do it, and so he had one of his attendants kill him. And so, like, he is actually killed with a mortal wound, a mortal slice to the head. And so this idea that people believe that Nero is going to return. And then part of the thing is there's this chaos. After Nero died, it was what was called the Year of Four Emperors. And so there was just chaos. And people thought, hey, maybe Rome is over. There's this kind of like joy among the people of faith. It's like, hey, maybe we're no longer going to be under Rome's thumb. But then Rome stabilized, and now we're back in the time of Domitian, which is essentially a second Nero. So Nero didn't actually rise from the dead, but essentially Domitian's just another Nero. And so the people of faith are saying, he's back. I mean, this is happening again.
Right. It's like he didn't rise from the dead, but yeah.
He might as well have.
That's the beauty of this literature, is that he didn't rise from the dead, but the wound was healed. The wound on the beast was healed, right? And okay, so if that's all like the first century context, if we zoom out and think, okay, well, what does this mean for disciples now? Like, I think it's, this beast is resilient, man. Like this beast, you can't just knock off one of the empires and think that the problem's gone. You know why? Because like we said, these empires are a manifestation of of fundamental evil. They're being animated by something even bigger than them that we cannot just kill with the sword. You know, we can't just take out Nero and say, okay, problem's over, because the wound will heal and a new Nero will come, or a new Rome will come. And so they can't just be conquered away, which is very interesting to me. And I think what gets me about this particular section is now we're getting the word worship in there, that they are worshiping the dragon and they're worshiping the beast, that the whole earth is marveling and following the beast, that, you know, obviously as we're talking about him, it's like, who would follow these? this is bad news. But yeah, that's the story that they're telling. And I think part of it is the resilience. Like, if you are up against a challenge and you're up against an evil, and you sort of, you know, even if you're like a video game or something like that, and you take on the big bad boss and you feel like you defeat him, and then he comes back, you're just like, okay, I give up. I cannot beat you. The evil and the power just starts to feel inevitable. Like, you can't overtake this. You can't win this battle. The evil's too strong. What it's like is, it's like Thanos, right? When he's like, what does he say? He's like, I am inevitable. Remember that?
That's a good line.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, evil's inevitable. So we might as well just lay down to it. And we'll see. It's like, being with evil might actually make us some money too. It might, like, the economic structures might be motivated by the dragon, but I might get paid. So one, I'm not going to die. And two, I might get paid through this. So I'm going to lay down to this evil. It's going to win anyway.
And there are two images. There, you know, we won't talk about the other one, but there are two like dominant images of the incarnation of the dragon. You know, you've got the beast and you've got a prostitute in a few more chapters. And there's this idea that, you know, the dragon's influence on Earth is, you know, just like raw power, just mm-hmm. like, you know, military might, raw power, but also seduction and pleasure. And, you know, that Rome is actually has these two corrupting forces. One is power and nationalism, and the other is just like pleasure and hedonism. And like, yeah, you could imagine like being rah-rah Rome, but also being like enjoying what Rome is doing like culturally, and just being like, yeah, I'll pinch incense to Nero or Domitian, sure.
Right.
And so if we believe, you know, that the beasts, that Babylon can be and have been present in multiple times, places, and modes, that means they're probably and certainly are present today. Like, they exist in our world today. And so the question that this lens reading of Revelation, this putting on these like heavenly lenses to look at what the cosmic reality underneath our structures is, the question that forces us to ask is, well, what power structures around me are displaying beastly qualities? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that there is one beast in the 21st century and that we should go out and identify it. It means that all of our power structures, whether they be governments or political parties or, you know, nation states or even just organizations and corporations, they can display beastly qualities. It is not that mm-hmm. all of them do, but many do.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep going. Revelation 13:5. And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints.
Holy interruption.
That.
Dude.
If that's not the greatest line ever, like, you're going to go straight up die. Here's a call for the endurance of the saints. Yeah. What a line.
Greatest line, or like most, like, dude, why did I join this team, man? This is a bad team.
But here's the thing.
We're going to lose.
But here's the thing, is that Revelation 12, and this is actually something we skipped over a little bit earlier. Revelation 12 sets the stage, like, the war has already been won. The battle has been won. The dragon has been cast down to earth with all its own form of a mortal wound, and it's kind of just thrashing about in rage. And yeah, just causing as much destruction as it possibly can, but its time is limited. Yeah. And the angels are in heaven and they're saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accusers of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them night and day before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. And so John is saying, here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints, because the way that the beasts and the dragon are conquered is through the witness of the saints. It is through the twofold witness, the first being witness to Yahweh on the throne. It is not Caesar on the throne. It is not the dragon on the throne. It is Yahweh on the throne. And the second kind of vocation of this witness is to speak out against Rome, to speak out against Caesar, to speak out against the dragon that animates them. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, that's the thing. That act of witness is what conquers this unholy Trinity. So absolutely, here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we just to kind of solidify this point, the culminating sentence is, okay, now you have all the clues, figure out who it is, right? Like the culminating sentence yeah. is, hey, let me tell you what this chapter is all about. Right. Here's why I just told you about a concatenated apex predator. It's because this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen not just to John's generation. It's going to happen to every generation that reads the words of this book. Mm-hmm. And the reason you need to know that is because you're going to be called to endurance and faithfulness.
Yeah. Well, and the fundamental ethic of the scriptures, but the fundamental ethic of Revelation is that the way to victory is inversely through laying down your life. You know, like John, it's like, hey, look, like, go look at the lion. And he goes and turns his head looking for the lion, and it's a slaughtered lamb is what he sees. You know, look for the victorious lion. And actually, what he turns his head expecting to see a victorious, wonderful lion, and instead he sees a slaughtered lamb. The way to defeat this thing is not through using their means and the might of overpowering. It's through, like, laying down your life. And so it shouldn't shock us that that's sort of the thesis at the end of this, is that if you are to be taken captive, go to captivity. And if you are to be slain, then you're going to be slain. And so endure and have faith. But don't capitulate. Do not compromise. You know, like, it's remain faithful to Yahweh through and through. You know, it's like such a high call. It's so much easier to talk about than to think about doing, man. Like, yeah. Oh, it's been unnerving me as I've been dealing with it. It's like, do I live this way? I don't know. You know, do I have this level of endurance? And I think it's okay to say no. It's okay to say, or I'm not sure. And that's why we have this, is to remind us, these are the stakes. This is the real story. This is what's really going on. You might be called to compromise. And what I'm telling you is, no matter what, don't do it.
And Peter, exactly what you're processing right now is what this book is designed to do. It is designed yeah. to open your eyes to what's around you and to make you ask the question, am I willing to do this? And to give you the encouragement to actually be willing to fight that hard, but fight in the sense right. of laying down your life.
So I told you that there was going to be two beasts. I think we've pretty well locked up the first beast. I think that we can be safe to say that John's talking about Rome, but we're also talking about all sort of like political entities that end up becoming this beastly empire as the story goes forward.
I have a little bit of an illustration here. Before we get to the beast, the second beast rises out of the land, which I think is really interesting and actually pretty important. But this is a beast that comes out of the sea. And we've kind of suggested that because of the Daniel narrative, it's a recapitulating beast. It's a beast that, in every generation comes out of the sea. Yeah. And I think that it just makes me think of Godzilla. Right,
like, dude, there's a new movie coming out, baby.
Yeah, yeah. That there's like, Godzilla has terrorized coastal cities in every generation, mm-hmm. and where does he go? I don't know, but he comes back and he terrorizes cities, mm-hmm. and he's always a little different. It's never like Godzilla never really looks the same from movie to movie, but it's the same basic idea and the same basic beast that emerges from the water. And that's the image I have here, is that in every generation, we face power structures that incarnate evil that are kind of bigger than the concatenation of the evil of the humans that are involved. In every generation is a call to endurance and faithfulness.
You know what illustration I had for the repetition kind of thing was that I was like, dude, this is just like Taco Bell. Like, they have a new menu. They have a new menu item that comes out, but it's the same stuff, dude. It's the same stuff. It's the same meat and cheese and tortillas, and they just have reorganized it and called it something new, but it's the same.
Babylon Bell.
Babylon Bell. Taco Babylon. So let's move on to the second beast. This one, I will say, I feel like I have a million thoughts on, and it scares me maybe even more than the next one. So again, stop me when you want to say something. But Revelation 13, 11. So we're moving on to the second beast. So then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon.
Stop.
All right. Holy interruption.
So Jesus gets called the lamb throughout Revelation. Every time Jesus is referred to in Revelation, it is as the lamb, with the exception of only two times. So the lamb in Revelation is Jesus. Yes. And now we have this second beast empowered by the first beast, empowered by Satan, and it looks like a lamb. It is masquerading as a lamb. People think this is Jesus in a way, you know, in some form or another, but it speaks like a dragon. It speaks with the mouth of Satan. It is pure evil on the inside, masquerading as light.
It's terrifying to me. It's terrifying to me. And we'll read on, because I have some more thoughts if we keep going, but keep that in mind. But so verse 12 says that this beast exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed, like we talked about. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Dude, I think the thing that scares me, so this is, I'm wholly interrupting myself, but so there, that line in there that this beast can make fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. I'm assuming that this is a callback to the Elijah story when Elijah, the one prophet of Yahweh, goes against the 100 prophets of Baal, and they have this sort of God off where it's like, okay, we'll see whose God is for real. I'm going to call fire down from heaven. You call fire down from heaven. We'll see which one does it. That's the God that's like legit. And obviously Yahweh does it, and it's like, wow. Huge victory for God. And Baal sucks, right? Baal was useless. And so when you read that story, it's like, well, yeah, like Yahweh should be the one you should worship because he's effective and Baal's not effective. Like Yahweh can do the fire bringing down and Baal cannot. But it's a totally different story if the Baal character can bring fire down from heaven. You know, if they just both do, then it's like, okay, well, that's a wash, you know? And that just freaks me out, you know, because it's like this being, this beast is sort of masquerading as Jesus. Like there's something about it that it's sort of concealing its evil and making people worship the beast sort of while wearing the clothes of a saint, you know, but it's able to do the stuff. Like it's able to do the miraculous thing. It's able to do the thing that would convince you that it's good. And that's terrifying to me. Mm. Any thoughts?
Absolutely. This haunts me. It really does.
Yeah. But I think maybe it haunts me because it's like this beast will do whatever it can to get you to worship and trust the beast and the dragon. Like it will act like God. It will act like Jesus. It will say the right thing. It will do whatever it can do to make you worship evil, to make you worship something that is not God, you know? And so I've heard people talk about this beast as like the propagandist of this Holy Trinity. Like this is the beast that's like propping up the other two and sort of doing things to make you worship them, which sort of makes sense. It's like if the dragon is sort of this cosmic dragon and then the first beast comes out of the sea, that's getting a little closer to us, right? But then this beast comes out of the earth, that's even closer to us. Like that's your next door neighbor, you know, it's getting ever more close to you. So probably ever more contextual to you. Does that make any sense what I'm saying? It's like it's making evil more and more palatable.
You know, what one of the things that N.T. Wright says about the beast from the sea and the beast from the land is that if you kind of think about how these churches in Western Turkey experienced occupation, right, like that Rome actually comes from the sea, mm-hmm. right? A lot of these are port towns, right? We talked about that. And so like these Roman ships with Roman garrisons actually come in from the sea. But then like we talked about with some of the collaborators actually rise up from inside the community
and become, you know, Roman and, you know, part of the Roman power structure. And so Wright actually says that this is one of the things that's going on, is that, you know, there's Rome, which is a kind of foreign entity. And then there are the people in your community that you know and love and care about who enable Rome's power and oppression.
And yes. So what this probably looks like in actuality is the civil religion of Rome, what is called the civil religion. And basically what that is mm-hmm. you know, the empire would or the emperor would often claim, you know, to be some form of the son of God or some form of God or whatever it is. And, you know, people would require people to worship him in some form or another. There was also this kind of notion that Rome was this chosen nation that was going to just bring peace and enlightenment to all of humanity, and that it was their task to do so. They were chosen by the gods. And so there's this religious twist to people's view of Rome, and it's kind of quasi-religious. It's not like full-blown religion. It's not really competing in the sphere of like the gods, but it is more than just, it's kind of a glorified form of patriotism. It's a quasi-religious patriotism is what it is. And this quasi-religious patriotism is leading to people to make Rome an idol and treat Caesar as Lord, not Yahweh. And this civil religion is this form of propaganda. It's making people think that they are this chosen nation, that they're righteous, that what they're doing, that the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, is the ultimate good of reality. And in blinding them to seeing, oh, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, is actually being achieved by extraordinary violence. That the wealth of Rome is built on the backs of slaves, something that John is actually going to call out later in the Book of Revelation. That this wealth, this right. power, this territory is not gained through, it's gained entirely through ill means. Mm-hmm. And when we look at this propagandist, quasi-religious patriotism in our modern day, kind of taking, you know, pulling it back from the first century, looking at it through our lens, we've got a scholar named Michael Gorman. He writes, you know, these kinds of power are not limited to the easy targets of criticism, such as totalitarian regimes. You know, you can easily point at Nazi Germany and say, oh, look at the propaganda of Nazi Germany. Clearly that was some form of this, but that doesn't exist, you know, anything like that in America or whatever. But the function of propaganda is to make evil look good. It's to make the dragon look like the lamb, to make the demonic look divine, to make violence look like peacemaking, to make tyranny and oppression look like liberation. It makes blind, unquestioning allegiance appear to be freely chosen, religiously appropriate devotion.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's so good. Because before you said that, I was thinking that this beast, its main skill seems to probably be making you think that this evil is actually good. You know, making you think this is in your best interest to say yes to this, to live this way, to convince you of its goodness, to... Because sort of like you were saying, I don't think that people know when they're worshiping something secular. Nobody in America, maybe if we're prone to be consumerists, you know, I don't think people know that they're consumerists. They don't know that in the way that someone who's religious would say that they believe in God, you know? Maybe the reason they don't know that is because they've just been told it's good. They've been told this is the way to the good life. They've been propagandized. And this sounds a little bit like I'm calling people out and it's not in me. I feel it in me. You know what I mean? It's like there's a tension and it's hard. It's sometimes I just feel totally overcome by this beast that's speaking the things that are evil being good. You know, it's even, I just got a new iPhone. And this is one of those topics that is so low hanging fruit, but I just got a new iPhone. And whenever someone brings up sort of the labor practices of some of these big companies, obviously like, I think like cheap labor in Asian countries and stuff, I just sort of like, yeah, you know, it's a price of business kind of thing, but it's not good. You know, it's like, these are human lives that are not being well cared for. And as a Christian, it does feel like I should not compromise in that, you know, and that's a whole can of worms I don't feel prepared to talk about. But I do think that the quasi-religious element of this is disturbing and is there. I found it interesting that later on in Revelation, when John is referring back to these three beasts, he describes this one as a false prophet. In chapter 16, 13, in chapter 19, 20, in chapter 20, 10, he refers to this as a false prophet. And you think about like what prophets were supposed to do were to like bring people back to Yahweh, And a false prophet is to go the other way, you know, lead people in a different direction. And so there's something religious going on here. There's something either religious or quasi-religious, just like you said. But I guess the really scary thing is if these people are in the church, if there's something that has sort of infiltrated the church that's making the people of God worship the beast. You know, again, opening a can of worms I don't feel prepared to talk about or qualified.
And there's two failure modes of this civil religion that can happen. The one is on the far right and one is on the far left. And the one on the far right, I'll briefly mention, I'll let Stanford tackle the one on the far left. But on the far right, you've got this syncretism between Christianity and, you know, we're in America, like American patriotism, where the things start to blend together in really weird ways. Mm-hmm. You get songs like God Bless America or our money having, you know, one nation under God on it, and starting to believe that, oh, we are God's country. You know, you start seeing American flags flying in churches. You start seeing, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance happening in churches. And John's going to stop and he's going to say, whoa, like, you get to pledge your allegiance to one thing, not two things. You get to pledge your allegiance to one thing. Mm-hmm. And there is a failure mode on the left as well.
That is to say, real fast, it's like you get to have allegiance to one thing doesn't mean like, hey, you don't get to love your country, you know, or have some pride in the country. But it's the right. Where's ultimate allegiance, I think, is a question.
And I would make a distinction between nationalism and patriotism, right? Like that, you know, I have patriotism for the town of Davis, like, because this is where I live. This is my community. These are my people, right? And I can have patriotism on larger scales as well. It just it's not as meaningful. But there's a failure mode on the left as well, right? Like there's this sense on the left that, you know, the state should be given more and more power mm-hmm. in order to fix all the problems. And really, that's putting hope in something, you know, large and powerful. The more power we give the state, the more problems we'll have fixed. And, you know, obviously, I work for the government. I'm a government employee. I'm glad money's given to the state, right? But this idea that the state will fix things, that's the answer to our problems. Well, you know, that's been tried several – that's right. A beast that's shown up several times in history and gone sideways.
Yeah. Certainly a – lesson from this, if not a full-blown sort of statement of reality, is just be weary of like political entities, especially very, very powerful political entities. Right. So can we move on?
Let's move on.
Let's read. Blessed are those who read the words of this book, and blessed are those who hear those who read the words right. of this book.
Verse 15 says, and it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Which is intense. But again, I'm going to interrupt myself, but like, again, this beast is like giving breath to this evil force. Like, it's giving them the words, it's giving them breath. So if we keep going, also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is the name of the beast or the number of its name.
Pause.
Yeah, I was going to pause here too.
Yeah. So we already talked about, Stanford talked about it last week. I believe it was the church in, was it Sardis? Or was Smyrna was the poor one. Smyrna was the poor church. We already talked about, you know, how participating in this civil religion, burning incense to Caesar, participating in meals of your trade guild, sacrificing to patron gods, was really critical to economic survival. If you were a blacksmith, and you refused to participate in, you know, the guild's worship of the patron god of blacksmithing, you were going to get boycotted in some form or another. There is a societal expectation that you were failing. And as Christians, it was unacceptable to be a part of that. And so they were suffering economically. And so when we see, you know, this mark of the beast, it's this super controversial, unbelievably speculative thing from anywhere from, you know, coronavirus vaccines to government chips inside people, you know, whatever it might be. It is the idea behind it for John is fundamentally economic. And it's just some marker of I am a participant in this machine that is generating wealth. If you're marked, you're a participant in this machine generating wealth. And if you are not going to participate in that, then you are not going to reap its rewards.
Yeah, one of the things that N.T. Wright says is that, you know, there were certain towns where, you know, all of these towns are built around this cult of Caesar, where you would have to go in and worship Domitian. And if you did the whole burn incense to Domitian, you'd actually like get a mark. They'd mark you. And that mark would actually like provide you entrance to the market. And if you didn't have it, you didn't get to go. And so there's a sense in which this mark is actually an economic symbol that is actually disqualifying Christians, not only from the public square or from polite society, but from the ability to like care for their families. And you know, as a dad, I am not sure what kind of courage I have to face like real martyrdom and physical violence. Who knows, right? But like, I know that being unable to provide for my family is that like that's really, really horrifying and would be the thing that would make me most likely to compromise. And so this is pretty dark, but also has like real historical reference, not necessarily some like future time at the end of the world.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, this might be a dead end. This might be a cul-de-sac, okay? But consider this counterfactual world. There is one computer company. That computer company's labor practices are suboptimal in the way that it treats the human beings making their products. And so there's no like, you can't, if you want a computer, you have to get it through this company. Huge monopoly, okay? And you need computers, especially like right now, right? You need computers to do work. You need computers to do Zoom. You need computers to do everything. And it feels like to me, it's a little bit of like, are you going to sort of support this process, or are you going to remain committed to the dignity of human beings and the values of the kingdom and all that stuff, you know? And it's like, well, the obvious answer to me is like, well, just buy the computer. There's lots of good that can be done with the computer. You know, you can do good work for the kingdom with the computer. You can talk to friends from far away with the computer. All sorts of things can be done. And so it's like, well, you have to do it. You have to work. You have to have the computer do any work. And I just wonder if like that's the kind of rationalization, that's the kind of compromise that he's talking about. You know, it's like, yeah, this stuff's bad, but look at what it gives me, you know?
I hate that premise. I hate it so much because, I mean, it's true. Yeah. Like, we make that decision almost every day. You know, that is our real world. We might not have one computer company, but we have two, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And,
right.
Yeah.
It really does
and
come
none
down.
None of them are fair trade.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no fair trade PCs, right? Like, no one's in that space.
Right.
I don't know about Linux. Maybe right. Linux is doing things right. Yeah, it really does come down to how utilitarian versus how idealistic are your ethics. And what is John asking of us in this moment? And it feels a little bit more on the idealistic side. But man, that's a hard argument to make. Like, that's a really hard argument to make.
But if you, I mean, the model is Babylon, right? The model here of Rome is Babylon, and the church is the exiled people of God, the Hebrews, as they lived in Babylon. And that, you know, the Jeremiah passage of how they're supposed to live in Babylon is, listen, you know, plant gardens, you know, work for the good of the city. That was a wicked city. It was not a morally great city, but work for its good, but maintain your distinct identity. And I do think that there's something fundamental here about the nature of worship. Now, how we spend our money, how we spend our time, those are acts of worship. So we want to be careful not to be too abstract. But like, also, just who you call God does matter.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I mean, both Jeremiah and Paul are going to tell people, pay your taxes to Babylon, pay your taxes to Rome. Rome's going to use them to fund warfare, certainly. But you should still do it anyways. You should be a good citizen. You should participate in the world. And John has some heavy-hitting language here. I think Stanford's right. Like, who is your God? Who is, you know, has Rome become an idol? Do you understand where you are? That's the big question. Do you understand the place that you are living in is the beast? Or do you think it is God or God's country, you know?
One thing that's really interesting about this mark is that it's a direct sort of inverse of the mark. I mean, even earlier in Revelation, Jesus marks his people on the forehead and on the hands, you know, like it's just the inverse of that. And, you know, I've heard people sort of talk about like this is a useful place to mark people, because obviously the foreheads, like, this is connected to your thoughts, your ideology, sort of your fundamental thoughts about the world. And then your hand is like the outworking of those thoughts. And so I don't think it's just like, did you make one decision that was sort of like for the empire? But it's like, what is like your fundamental posture toward reality? Is it that this empire, this thing, this sort of bestial thing, because it can give me what I want, like, I'm just going to follow this. I'm going to go to the altar of the empire. And it's just interesting, like, again, like, worship language is all over this passage, this chapter. And so, and I think, once again, like, we talk about this all the time in College Life, but we are just worshiping critters. Like, we are going to go to the altar of something. Mm-hmm. We are going to offer our lives to the altar of something. And I think what this chapter is doing is saying, hey, you might think it's sort of like, oh yeah, I'm just going to do life the way that the rest of Rome does life. And that doesn't seem too bad. It's working out for everyone else. And what this chapter is saying, no, apocalypse time. I'm going to show you what's really behind this. You know, you're serving the beast. You are worshiping the beast by doing this. Anyway, I feel like these passages make my mind go nuts. Mm-hmm. You know, it just feels – and I think because they're meta, you know, it's like – it's because they're saying, hey, here's the superstructure of the story. And you sort of think, yeah, what am I doing that? Is that me right now? And I think it leads us well to verse 18, which says, man, this calls for wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's literally the next thing it says. This calls for wisdom because it's hard to know. Like, it's not just easy to know, am I worshiping the beast or am I worshiping Yahweh? I don't think it's clear cut all the time. This calls for wisdom. And so John continues, let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Boom, period. That's it. But the last sense that we get is, this is a big deal, and you need wisdom to know. And especially because this second beast is such a propagandist and is a false prophet, you're not going to be able to trust everything. I guess this is the sense I get. You know, it's like a false prophet. You don't know a false prophet is a false prophet unless you have wisdom. You don't. You know, like, you're going to be led astray. Something's going to sound really good to you. And
the second beast is great on Twitter.
Yeah, second beast is great on Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then anything more to say about 666? We talked about how it's if you add up the numbers of Nero's name in a couple different ways, you get 666.
Yeah, it's not worth a conversation to have right now, frankly, because it's just not that interesting. It very well could be a reference to Nero. It might not be. If you're curious about it, Richard Bauckham has a book called The Theology of the Book of Revelation. Fantastic book. He's probably the foremost Revelation scholar in the world. Mm-hmm. And he details this with more detail than you could possibly ever want, and examines a bunch of other theories and stuff. So you can read that if you're really curious about it. It's probably not as interesting as you want it to be. Is this the reality, though?
Yeah. I feel pretty compelled by the incomplete, like, imperfect 666 idea. And I'll just pitch it really fast, is that, like, if 7 is the perfect number and number of perfection, and then it sort of makes some sense that, like, one less than that, it almost has this feeling of like an unended story. Mm-hmm. It has the feeling of like, it's like just not cooked enough chicken. It's like, it's almost there, and yet it's gonna make you sick. You know, it's like, it's an imperfect. And then if you have 3 of them, it's sort of a complete imperfection. Yeah. Perfect imperfection. You know, it's, you will perpetually be less than, perpetually be imperfect. And so that, I feel like that is compelling to me. It's like, this is, as long as reality is going on, this beast, although it might try to act like God, it might try to, again, put on the clothes of God, but it is not. It is a counterfeit. It is imperfect and bad, evil. Bad news. So I like that. I think it's like, even if it is Nero, it's like, Nero's just another example of this 666. Nero's just another example of this will always be perfectly imperfect. You know what I mean? So I don't know actually how palatable that theory is amongst the scholars, but I've heard it and I think it makes sense. And I think it makes sense following some of the breadcrumbs that we've already been given through Revelation 13. All right. Any last thoughts on Revelation 13? That was a mighty meal we just ate. So I want to end our time of Revelation, which, again, as Stanford brought up last week, is really ending our 4-year cycle, our 4-year journey through the scriptures. Started way back 4 years ago in the Gospels, and we've gone through them all, and now we're closing the book on it. And so I want to end with a little, like, dessert, a little Revelation dessert. Like, we talked about some of the hard stuff today, but, you know, Revelation is full of images, and some of them are just magnificent. And I just think if we were to put these images sort of in our back pocket. If this was the screensaver we could have on the back of our computer or on our phone and we just had them on our mind, we would be better for it. And so I've sort of asked all of us to come up with what's like one image you want to paint really fast, really quickly of Revelation that you kind of want us to leave our journey through the scriptures with. Christian, you want to go first?
I'll be chronologically first. So yeah, I'll go first. So we've already talked about it a little bit, but chapters 4 and 5 of Revelation, it's the first throne room vision that John has. And it's where John is with these elders and they say, you know, God is sitting on the throne and he's got the scroll in his hand, and the scroll is the plan for humanity and for all of creation. It is the, you know, everything that is going to happen, but no one can unfurl the scroll, and they're weeping. And one of the saints in the throne room, he says, "Hey, look, there's the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He can open the scroll." And John looks and he sees the slaughtered lamb. And at that moment, you understand how God rules creation. He does not rule it as a ferocious lion like Rome does. He rules it through the power of the slaughtered lamb. And I mean, it's even come to have a name. There's a couple of scholars that call it lamb power. And it's silly, but it's this idea that like real power comes through sacrificial love. That is how God rules the universe. And that is how God will defeat evil, is through sacrificial love. And that is how we defeat evil, through sacrificial love. The rest of Revelation is the story of God's people following the lamb through sacrifice, through death, and out into the new creation.
That's magnificent. That's like magnificent, that image. And yeah, thanks for bringing it up. I'm gonna jump on that because mine's similar to you. Mine is actually it's actually a horrible image, but it's beautiful in its horror. But I'm going to Revelation 19, and Revelation 19 is, you know, like, we just talked about Revelation 13. We talk about the beasts and stuff. They don't go away. Like, they can continue on in this story. And Revelation 19 is sort of where they meet their end. You know, we talked a lot about how scary these forces are, these beasts are. How we talked about how it's like, man, are they going to kill us? Like, are they going to actually kill us? Is this going to be bad news? And they seem all-consuming in their power. They seem resilient. We cannot seem to defeat them. And so we need someone to defeat them. And so in Revelation 19, man, it's crazy. We see Jesus show up to this battle, and he shows up on this white horse. It's sort of a very familiar image to us. If Lord of the Rings, like Gandalf shows up on a white horse to save the day in, what is it, Helm's Deep? You know, it's like this familiar image of this savior riding in on a white horse, saving the day. But the thing that's interesting is that he shows up and his clothes are soaked in blood. And you might think, okay, well, you know, it's a battle. But the thing is, like, this is before the battle's even happened. The battle, he hasn't done anything yet. There's been no fighting yet, and yet his clothes are just soaked in blood. And a few things to just point out from that is that basically the climax of the battle has already happened, and it's actually not in Jesus violently overthrowing these beasts. It's actually in his sacrificial death on the cross. So he's bloody because he's been killed on the cross, Jesus has. And that was actually the death knell for these beasts. And that, again, that's magnificent. We were told that the beasts could not be overtaken by the sword, and Jesus uses the sword of his word and defeats them. And so, I mean, it is good news that that was an understatement. I mean, it's unbelievable news, best news possible, that this thing that's been animating the evil in the world is going to be defeated, and actually has been defeated on the cross. And so there is an end to this story, this whole beastly story that we talked about. And the end starts in Revelation 19 with Jesus, who shows up to battle in blood-soaked clothes and sort of inverts what it means to get victory. He doesn't get victory. He doesn't get bloody by the battle. He gets bloody because he gets overtaken by the evil and yet remains victorious through it. Does that make any sense? Pretty good.
Yeah.
What do you got, Stanford?
Well, we'll just go to the final pages, right? The final pages of Revelation and the scriptures end with a vision of the new Jerusalem, of the new city, of the city of God. And it's, you know, we would be tempted to use the word heaven, except heaven's a word that means more and less, right? Like, this is a new creation where God's people will live into eternity future in a like concrete material and spiritual mm-hmm. state. And so that's all really important, that, you know, that we're not like ghosts and machines that will, you know, then become our true selves as ghosts and fly away to some other place, right? Like in the next age, we are going to inhabit a city, an urban landscape. And one of the things I love about this, you know, I studied restoration ecology at Davis, and restoration ecology is this idea that, you know, we're going to take some of these landscapes that have been ruined by humans and we're going to turn them back to the way they were. And this has real resonance with the Christian imagination, because we're going to restore it back to yeah. the way God made it. But like, when? You know, like during the Pleistocene, or, you know, like when it was its original state? Where are you actually trying to get it back to? So one of my professors at Davis was really into what he called reconciliation ecology, where there's this idea that, you know, these landscapes are fundamentally altered by human creation, but that they are also like fundamentally beautiful as their kind of initial creation, to kind of put it into Christian language. And so there's this idea that we could knit together the human built environment with the natural environment, or, you know, the original creation with God's co-creation, into these spaces that are like livable and green. And anyway, listen to this description of the riparian zone of the New Jerusalem, because I just think it's a beautiful image of like this harmony that God has in mind. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the streets of the city. Also on either sides of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healings of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him, and they will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and the night will be no more, and they will need no light of the lamp or sun. The Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever.
There it is. There it is. That's a great way to end it, is just reading that. That's an image that that I long for. It's certainly a refreshing image from what we talked about today. You know, we got deep That's into right. the beasts. We got deep into the repetition of evil. We got deep into the, hey, you defeat one evil, another one's coming up. And actually, at the end of the story, it's this wonderful garden place where rivers are flowing, mm-hmm. and we actually get to eat of the tree. Man, that's great. I got nothing else to say.
What a conclusion to a four-year journey. I was just thinking about it. I was in the first class when we started that. I was a junior when we started that four-year journey.
Well, guys, thanks for diving into this. I know it was some heavy lifting historically and scripturally. So let's just do one last quarantine corner for the quarter. And maybe we won't be able to do much more of these. Maybe quarantine will end sooner than we hope. Who knows? But
sooner than we think. Maybe not sooner than we hope.
Yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah, that's what I mean. Sooner than we think. All right, I'll go first for quarantine corner. How about that? Yeah. So I've always had this image in my brain that I've never really felt like I've become. But I always think, you know, this is maybe a bigger topic for Quarantine Corner, but like, I'm not as evangelistic as other people in the Christian world. And that is a bummer.
Yeah.
But I guess I sort of think I'm just so sold on like people become Christians and people follow God based on like relationships they have with someone that they care about, you know? And it's like, then that person's the entrance to them. And so I'm always like, I feel like the kingdom should spread and the gospel should spread like street by street, like neighborhood by neighborhood, you know? It's like that, it's like the smallest possible thing, and then you magnify it out. And so that is a very theological way of saying what I think you should do is you should hang out in your front yard. If you have a front yard, if you have a driveway, please hang out in the driveway. Man, we are having so much fun in our driveway. We got, I mean, Mason brings his cars out there and we're out there a couple hours a day and he just pushes the cars downhill. We got chalk. Dude, chalk is so fun. If you want to have fun, just get chalk and just like let you be a kid, yeah. you know, just draw stuff. Yeah. And we've gotten like all the kids in the neighborhood are like coming to our driveway now. And we're meeting friends. We have these, it's been so fun. Like we're meeting friends. Their name's Johnny and Amanda. And they have these two little kids and our families are like are like growing together and we're becoming like real friends, and it's magical. And if we were just in our house or in our backyard, never would have happened. And so I think you should, if you're in an apartment, I don't really know what to tell you. Maybe go
to the park.
Just to the park to the park or something. But if you have a front, if you have a driveway and or a front yard, I think you should hang out in it. I think good things happen when you're just out in public. And I got to say, we live right by the mailbox too. And so there's this guy that comes, name's Dan, and he comes, he always gets the mail, similar time of day. And we got into a conversation today, and I got to tell you, just, can I be honest?
Yes, yes, be honest.
I crushed the small talk.
This is me not surprised. About as good, this is me not being surprised.
It was about as good as small talk as you can imagine. Yeah. We laughed, we talked about interesting things, a little bit of sports, a little bit of church stuff. It was fantastic. It was a clinic on small talk. And so he says that when the pandemic's over, he would like to have us at his house for dinner.
That's great.
So
that's great.
One of the things are happening, man. Go to your
yeah. One of the follow-ups there is when you buy a house, like build a front porch. Right. Like I think it is actually like suburban architecture that really like encloses people in their backyards and kind of, you know, it breaks down that neighborhood vibe, especially chain link fences in the front. Like, yeah, just build your life a little bit around that front space for sure.
Yeah, I'm in. All right. You take it away. Who's next? All Christian. Right.
So my true quarantine corner is I've been playing a lot of chess. Before you ask, yes, I watched The Queen's Gambit. Yes, it was fantastic. Yes, I'm on the bandwagon. Yes, I'm insensitive about, or I am sensitive to that as part of my self-image being degraded because I thought I was an original human being. Now I realize that I'm just like everybody else. It's fine. But because there's been enough chess content on this podcast already
Who did that? Who's responsible for that?
Before
the Queen's Gambit, I'll tell you, I was before the Queen's Gambit.
all right, Stanford. All right. So I've been playing my alternative here. I've been playing board games with my coworkers at lunch. Our lunch breaks have now been used to play board games together, which has been delightful. Mm-hmm. My recommendation to you is to find a random excuse to go play board games with people, your roommates or strangers or whoever you want, because they're delightful and they're fun and they build a sense of camaraderie and competition, and they're intellectually stimulating and, you know, board games.
And
board games, man.
Board games with coworkers at lunch is actually brilliant. We did that for years in my office. And It formed relationships, like real, yeah, like legitimate relationships. Using your lunchtime to build relationships by doing something fun together. Can't recommend it enough. Yes. Sorry, I'm just like riffing off of all yours. Okay, here's mine.
I know you're very affirming today.
Here's mine.
Affirming Stanford.
Throwing knives. So last week, yes, the tarantulas did arrive. Yes, they're adorable. Yes, my children have gotten into bow and arrows and we're going down to the Davis archery range. Yes, we're turning into a strange family.
Very strange.
Yeah. But
exceedingly strange.
But yes, we play a lot of chess. But here's the thing. You have now met my brother. You have some sense of who this character is in my life. And I will just tell you that when we exchange Christmas gifts, sometimes we make a list. And this time my wife said, hey, you have kids. Your kids are older than ours. You know what kids like. Just get us something cool. And so Xavier is opening his Christmas gift on Christmas Day, and it is a set of 9 throwing knives.
Nine
throwing knives. And so we watch a couple YouTube videos, because that's what you do when you receive throwing knives for Christmas. And we have just been loving it. We've been like learning how to get the right number of rotations. And of course, now my kids watch a show where some hero throws a knife and it stabs someone like 5 miles away while they're running, and they're like, you can't do that. This is really hard. No, it's hard to throw a knife. Yeah,
calling them out.
Yeah, so we are throwing knives.
I'm going to tell a cautionary tale really quick, just so that Xavier doesn't grow up into this person. So many of you remember my former roommate, Charlie Hunt. So he bought a set of throwing knives at one point while we were living together, and I was doing homework in my room, and I hear a thud, thud, thud against the wall just for like 20 minutes. What is going on out there? And I walk outside, and they're throwing knives into the drywall. in our apartment. And I was like, what are you doing? And they're like, it looked fun. And we were like, I'm trying
to find the stud.
My favorite thing was what, you know, we went out to the garage and we put up a target. It wasn't the drywall, very accurate. And behind the target, Amanda has all of our COVID supplies, including pancake batter. And at one point, I pierced the pancake batter and it came pouring out. Nice. And I felt, I did not feel shame. I felt cool. I was like, I just pierced the pancake batter.
Also, for anybody that's wondering, we did not get our security deposit back.
Yeah. You kissed that money goodbye, baby. Shocking. All right, guys, that's a wrap for us and a wrap for the quarter. All right, that's it for the pod and for Revelation and for the quarter and for our 4-year journey through the scriptures. This is a big day. But before we end the podcast, I want to read the words of Tim Mackey as he sums up his conversation on Revelation in the Bible Project. And I think it could help us. He says that the pastoral role of Revelation is to summon every generation of readers to follow the Lamb in its footsteps and to resist the beast within and without, and to suffer along with the Lamb, if need be, in bearing witness to what he's done. If that's not where it ends, we've totally missed the purpose of Revelation. I love it. So thank you, Stanford, for another quarter dealing with the many hours planning and recording these podcasts. I'm glad that I never get tired of having conversations with you. Thank you to Christian Wingate for being game to talk dense theology late at night on a Thursday evening. What a friend you are. And thanks to all the speakers this quarter, Christian again, and Olivia, Brant Nanda, Joe and Jenny, Rick Morris, Steve Luxa, Bronwyn Lee, Nick Gibson, and of course, Daryl Johnson. You all were the mouthpieces bringing God's word to us, so thank you for that. And of course, thank you, Josh Paskey and Scooter King Kyle Jung, for the music of your pod and your staff. It is top shelf. And thank you to Mike Loretto for doing a whole season editing our show. You were given countless technical errors, imperfect audio, long recordings, and you made our show happen. What a pleasure it's been. But before we go, College Life, we love you more than the glorious feeling of finishing your last final of the quarter. We can't wait for you to experience it. See you next quarter.